Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Bill Grant, co-chair of the club's Health and Medicine Member-led Forum and chair of this program. And now it is my pleasure to turn the program over to journalist and radio host Anna LaPay, who will lead the discussion with Frederick Kaufman on his new book, Bet the Farm, How Food Stopped Being Food. Anna LaPay is a widely respected author and educator, known for her work as an expert on food systems and as a sustainable food advocate. The co-author or author of three books and a contributing author of 10 others, Anna's work has been widely translated internationally and featured in the New York Times, Gourmet, Oprah Magazine, among other many other outlets. Named one of Time Magazine's Eco Who's Who, Anna is a founding principal of the Small Planet Institute and the Small Planet Fund. She is currently directing the Real Food Media Project and its first initiative, Food Mythbusters, which uses creative movies and online action center and grassroots events to grow the movement for sustainable food and farming. Anna?
Thank you. And good evening, everyone. Welcome. I am very excited to be here. I think we're in for a real treat to hear from Fred and his new book. I want to begin by just introducing Fred Kaufman for those who aren't familiar with his work. His latest book is Bet the Farm, which we'll be talking about this evening. He is a contributing editor to Harper's Magazine, and his work has appeared in Scientific American, Nature, Popular Science, the New York Times Sunday Magazine, and many other publications. He is also a professor at CUNY Graduate School of Journalism in New York City and a frequent public speaker. He has spoken everywhere from lecture halls at Yale University to the halls of the United Nations. And I personally first came across Fred's work when I read an article in Harper's Magazine in 2010 called The Food Bubble. And if you haven't read it, I highly recommend it. And it really exposed to me a whole different way of thinking about food. In the article, Fred talked about how Wall Street speculators had manufactured mayhem on wheat markets, helping to drive the food price crisis of 2008 and 2009. His article was really the first time I had seen a journalist give a thorough account of how food had become financialized. Now, if food becoming financialized is a hard concept for you to get your head around, hopefully this evening will help you understand just what that means. And in his latest book, Fred really tackles this idea and has this uncanny ability to make these really big concepts very digestible, and I'll try not to use too many other food puns this evening. His book took him for research everywhere from shiny research labs to Domino Pizza factories to the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. And so tonight, I'm going to ask Fred some questions. I hope that you all also ask Fred some questions, so you all have slips of paper. You can write your questions on them and pass them up to me. And what we're going to talk about tonight, like I said, is his new book, Bet the Farm, and this idea of what the financialization of food really means, how it impacts you and me, why it matters, and what we can do about it. So we'd like to begin by asking, Fred, I know for many years you were a food writer, but all of a sudden we have found you delving into complicated financial tools developed by Goldman Sachs. Can you talk about how your interest moved from food to finance?
Yes, first of all, thank you, Anna, and it's a real honor and a pleasure to be back at the Commonwealth Club. And Anna's absolutely right. I had spent about 10, 15 years of my life writing kind of, some might say, whimsical cultural pieces about American food landscape, you know, the food network and gastro porn and kosher food and kosher enzymes and all manner of bizarre American food ways. And I got sick of it eventually. And I had dinner with my editor, my longtime editor, and I said, I'm done. I'm done, Luke. Enough about food. And he said, oh, no, Fred, you got to now do no food. And the truth was that I was a little bit, I had a great bit of trepidation about entering any kind of encounter with world hunger for many reasons. You know, it's a scary, big monster of a topic. People have been thinking about this for a long time. Since people have been eating, people have been thinking about what to do about hunger. And so I have to say I entered it with some trepidation.
Mm-hmm. but you dived right in, wrote a whole book about it. So I was talking to Fred about his book, and I was joking with him that I'm probably the only person who has a joke about collateralized debt obligations in her wedding vows. But that's what happens when you marry a financial analyst. So even though I had a joke about collateralized debt obligations in my wedding vows, I don't necessarily admit to completely understanding what exactly that means. And I'm probably not the only one. I would love for you to just sort of help those of us who might not be financial analysts to understand deeper about this connection between food and finance, and to help us understand what is that connection between a derivative and a donut, or a derivative and Domino's pizza.
Well, you know, the original question for the book was a much more basic question, and the question was, how can delicious and healthy and inexpensive food be available for everybody on Earth? And at first I thought, well, I should go to the people who promise that if we leave them alone, they will feed the Earth, and those are the great purveyors of industrialized food. And I got permission to go and hang out with the people at Domino's Pizza. And I spent a lot of time and heard about how pizza was going to feed the world. And well, it's a big, they're multi-billion dollar industry, and there's pizza all over. And I thought maybe they got a point here. And I really spent a lot of time and energy figuring out what it was they were doing. And when all was said and done, I realized that they really were not focusing on pizza as much as they were focusing on money. And that food for them had simply become yet another entry in a vast spreadsheet of profit and loss. And so they disappointed me. So then I thought, well, maybe since food isn't working in this macro way in terms of feeding the world, I thought maybe I would try to go in the most micro way possible, as small as possible as opposed to big as possible, and what was smaller than a food molecule. And so I started going around the country. I spent about a year doing this, going from one genetic modification lab to another, because a lot of the people who are involved in creating genetically modified food are promising that their work is going to actually help feed the world, and they are going to have the solution to a world that with climate change is increasingly has drought and flood and freeze. And right, so I spent a lot of time with them too, and I looked at all their laboratories and saw some amazing things. I saw some, you know, maybe we can talk about what I saw later. I don't want to get too far off track right off the bat. But I realized that ultimately they, too, were not interested in food. What they were actually looking at was food as an intellectual property right, as a patent right. They were trying to earn their rent off food. So once again, food was not food. Food was money. And so then I thought, well, maybe searching for the answer to this question, maybe it's politics, maybe it's the UN, maybe it's the big people of the Food and Agriculture Organization of the UN, and I went to their big conference in Rome, and which they have every 5 years, and this was in 2008 when the hunger numbers were through the roof and we were seeing almost a billion food insecure people on Earth. Ironically, that was the same year we had the greatest wheat harvest in the history of wheat harvests. There is more food. There is enough food to feed double the people on the planet, and yet a billion people were going hungry. So in the midst of all these ironies, really horrifying ironies, I went to Rome and listened to what everybody was saying there. And the answer, the most cutting-edge answer I found there, was that we needed to set up commodity markets like we have in Chicago and Minneapolis and Kansas City in this country. We needed to set them up in Rwanda and Tanzania and Guatemala and all these places that were the most food insecure of all. And once again, I was very frustrated. I was like, once again, they're not talking about food. They're talking about money. And so I went home rather dejected. Long answer to your question, Anna, but I'm getting to the end. And I went home dejected, and I said, everywhere I'm trying to find food, what I'm finding out, the harder I push, is money. And so I called up Amartya Sen. And Amartya Sen had won the Nobel Prize in Economics and had been kind of the creator of the field of development economics. And I hoped he might explain what was going on. Nobody understood hunger like Amartya Sen had understood hunger. And I told him what I just told you. And, you know, he laughed at me. And he said, Fred, that's precisely the issue, is that people don't go hungry because there isn't enough food. People go hungry because they cannot afford the food. It's all about the money. And so I walked away from that meeting thinking to myself, well, then if that's the case, then instead of focusing on food, I actually should be focusing on the money. And that's when I really started trying to figure out how the banks, and when I mean the banks, I mean the large investment banks, the Goldman Sachs and the J.P. Morgan Chases and Deutsche Bank and Barclays Bank, these monstrous financial institutions had gotten their claws into global food system and had subverted the price setting mechanism. And that is how derivatives right. relate to donuts.
Right. So can you talk a little bit more about how that happened, about why, when, and how that was happening? And, you know, I think in your book you talk about how important it is to think about the market for food. And when you talk about market, you're talking about markets. You're not talking about, you know, the farmer's market down the road from us or Berkeley Bowl. You're talking about the financial market. So can you talk a little bit about more about what's happening in those markets that is so undermining people's ability to address the root causes of hunger?
Well, you know, at one point, Anna, it was the Berkeley Bowl. It was the market. I mean, the food and the interesting thing that when I started to really research this was the obvious, which is that for 10,000 years, ever since the birth of agriculture, some people say 11,600, but we'll just say 10, food and money are related very closely and for good reason, which is that generally it's generally accepted that civilization happens in cities. The first, you know, if you study your eighth grade social studies, Mesopotamia and Egypt, all these city-states is where civilization begins. And the problem with the early city-states is that what you have to do is support a bunch of people in the city with their daily bread, which is made outside the city. And so you need a very intimate connection and a daily connection between those who are making the food and those who are consuming the food in the city. And the way that happens, for the most part, is through currency and through money. And so from the very beginning, there's been a problem, which is food, we need it every day, but it only comes out of the earth maybe twice a year, right? And not only that, we want, if we're living in the city, like all of us, we want a stable price for food, right? We don't want to be able, at some point in the year, we don't want to have to spend $100 for a loaf of bread, and another part of the year just have to spend 10 cents for a loaf of bread. And so you can kind of trace the arc of civilization as the attempts and the correct attempts, the successful attempts to wed food and money so that the farmer can make a living, so that the baker can make the living, so that the consumer in the city, that all of us are satisfied. And there are a lot of ways through history that emperors and kings made this happen. And what happened at the end of the 19th century in this country is a situation kind of similar to what happened in 2008, which is that there's a huge financial crisis in this country called the Panic of 1857. And it was the stock market crashed, and there was a real estate debacle, and everybody lost money. And in the wake of this crisis, the founders of what today we would call Big Ag, like Mr. Archer, Mr. Daniels, and Mr. Midland, and Mr. Pillsbury, all these guys who were alive back then said, this screwed us up. This messed up our business model. We did not make enough money. So we have to figure out a way that this won't happen again and that we can keep making profits no matter what happens economically. And so they created the modern-day commodity market. So there are a couple of things we have to remember here. One, people created markets. It's not that markets kind of exist on their own in some pure Platonic realm of spiritual sanctity, right? That people created them. And also, the founders of Big Ag, these guys created them highly regulated markets with lots and lots of rules, okay? That was how these markets were first created, these commodity markets. Third of all, we have to remember why they were created. They were created to stabilize the price of food, right? And they were also created so that everybody who was involved in the creation of food, in other words, the farmers and the millers and the warehousers and the bakers, so they could find what should be the quote-unquote true price of food, Okay, it's called price discovery. That's why these markets, these huge commodity markets, were created about 150 years ago. And they were so successful, if I could just go on for one second, they were so successful, we saw these commodity markets not just in food, but in cat pelts and in molasses and in almost anything that could be bought and sold on a mass level. People realized, whoa, we should make a market for this, a big commodity market. And the price stabilizing mechanism is a very simple concept behind it to keep that price stable for consumers in the city so this doesn't wildly fluctuate. You have to remember that when food comes out of the ground, and the classic example is the Dojima rice market in Nagasaki about at the end of the 18th century. The problem for the Japanese at that point was that all the rice farmers would bring all their rice to market at a certain point in the year, in the fall. And of course, when all that rice came to market and there's this glut of supply, the price would plummet. And the farmers would walk away with very little money. Later in the year, in the spring, when there's less and less rice, the price of rice would start rising and rising again. Of course, the farmers didn't have any rice at that point. The people who had rice were the rich people who had bought all the rice when it was cheap and had hoarded it and held it, and so they had made a lot of money. And so the Japanese said, look, food is different. They were early foodies. Food is different. Food is sacred. Food is too necessary to our society to have these wild price fluctuations. And so they actually set bans. The government set price bans for rice. The commodity markets that were created about 150 years ago, and this is the last thing I'll say about them for this question, there was no government at that point that could set prices the way the Japanese emperor could set prices. So instead they used a very ingenious idea that had actually been around, once again, since the birth of agriculture, and that was the promise. That's all commodity markets are. They're organized promises. And so, in other words, if I am making wheat or rice or any kind of grain, and Anna here to my right do you bake, Anna?
Sometimes. Yeah, sometimes. I've been known to bake.
Sometimes. So she's going to buy it. All basically we're saying is that, you know, let's say is that we know when all is said and done after years and years and years that the fair price for a 60-pound bushel of corn is $5. We know that because I'm a farmer and she's a baker. And so all we're doing is I'm saying to Anna, okay, I'm going to deliver to you a 60-pound bushel today, and I'll deliver one to you 2 months from now, and I'll deliver one to you 6 months from now, and I'm promising to deliver them to her going forward. And she's promising to buy them. That's a futures market. That's what it is. That's what these futures markets are. They're organized systems of promises. And obviously, the first thing that we understand is that we just stabilized price, didn't we? We just stabilized the price of corn simply by partaking in that agreement of forward. They're called forward contracts of promises going forward.
Okay, so let's jump way ahead, because it's sounding like you have these mechanisms where you create these markets, you're stabilizing the price, and the farmers are getting a set price. They're able to then be forward-thinking themselves and have capital that they can use to invest in the farm, right? And you mentioned that these markets are very regulated. I remember reading a quote from the chairman of Archer Daniels Midland from many years ago, who famously said, there is not a single grain in the world traded on the free market. The free market is only found in the speeches of politicians. So this idea that you have these regulated markets, they're there for a reason. It's all sort of what you said so far is kind of making sense. This is what we need. We need this in this special production thing called food. So let's fast forward when all of this now seems to actually not be working in our favor, and we have this incredible food price spike, 2008, 2009, and we've had it again. And for those of you who know that recent history, you'd know that that one price spike period, 2008 to 2009, pushed hundreds of millions of more people around the world into hunger. So what's happened now to these markets for food, and how has it undermined, in a sense, their reason for being, which was that stabilization purpose?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I just want to underscore a part of the question before we get to the answer. And so there have been two great world food crises already in the 21st century. There's the food crisis of 2008, when the global price of food doubled and then doubled again. And then the price of basic foodstuffs, that's grains, let's say, went even higher in 2010, 2011. And the price of the world's food has yet to go back down, and it doesn't look like it's going to go back down. Now, we can talk later, if you like, about why Americans, that price signal, or Americans don't quite see it so much as the rest of the world, and there's some very interesting reasons for that. But how did that happen, and why did that happen? And so one of the factors is the Goldman Sachs Commodity Index, which this great transnational bank created in 1991. So I'm going to try and give a very, very short explanation of what this commodity index is and what it did, and then maybe we'll talk about how it completely messed up the global price of food. So the bottom line is, in our little example of Anna and I stabilizing the price of corn going forward, right, I promised to sell to her and she promised to buy for me, right? And this was going to happen going forward, 2 months from now, 6 months from now. So Goldman thought, brilliantly as it turned out, and often people always want to blame Goldman Sachs, but in fact, what they figured out was so brilliant in its own way, that it was copied by many, many banks, and it's really become a part of the entire financial system right now. So we can't just blame them. They were just the smartest guys in the room in 1991. The idea was that there are these things now called commodities, and of course grain is a commodity. Corn and soy and wheat are the agricultural commodities. And then there's another sector of commodities, the metals. And so people trade gold and silver and palladium. And then there's another sector, which is energies. So people trade different kinds of oil and jet fuel and this sort of thing. Of course, there's livestock and right? And all of these are separate, and all of these are made to stabilize those prices for the most precious things on Earth, right? That's the structure. What Goldman did is they thought, wait. These markets are almost like working too well. The prices is very stabilized. There is a real opportunity here to make a lot more money if we can bring more volatility into these markets. If we can make them move around a lot more peaks and valleys, right? They'll make money. As we all know about the stock market, you know, I remember learning as a kid, right? It doesn't matter if the stock market goes up or the stock market goes down, the stockbroker makes money, right? It's all about the volatility. So they figured out we can introduce volatility to this market, and we can also bring a lot more money into these commodity markets. So what they did is they figured out, instead of buying and selling going forward, they said, okay, let's make a purely artificial mathematical construct here, and let's add all the commodity prices together, and then let's subtract a few and divide this and do this and you know sing tra-la-la and make one single line for all of them. That's the index. It's just a line of differently weighted commodity prices going forward, and then let's sell shares in it. So that then anybody who wants to get in on commodities like food as the price rises can do so. Now, if you think about it, there's more than one problem with this idea. I mean, the basic problem is you have to remember is great if the price goes up, but of course, as the price goes up, that also means that people starve and people go hungry because food costs more. But that seemed to have evaded them. But the even more basic problem is that it goes contrary to economic sense, to basic economic sense, which is that, remember, I promised to sell and Anna promised to buy. But the way the commodity index worked is that Goldman only bought. They never had any wheat to sell, and they were never selling all their accumulated shares. You would buy shares in it, hoping that at going forward, it would just go up and up and up. So you continuously had to buy in and buy in and buy in. And this went contrary to the structure of the commodity markets, which had been meant to stabilize food. And it also went contrary to basic economic knowledge, the idea that you'd buy and keep buying no matter what. And this is the kind of the monkey wrench that was thrown into global commodity markets in 1991. So then if I could just follow it up with one, the next step is, of course, well, if this happened in 91, how come we didn't have this monster of an effect until 2008, 2010, 2011? Well, that was the machinery. The machinery was there to screw up the system, but the money wasn't there. The money wasn't there. And so what we're seeing from 2003 to 2013, in the last 10 years, we're seeing a lot of fear out there in financial markets. I mean, right now the stock market is doing very well, but this is really a fairly recent phenomenon of the last year. A tremendous amount of fear and a tremendous amount of sense of people with a lot of money. Where do we put our money? Do we put it in real estate? No, that's a bad idea because real estate is tanking. Stock markets were not doing well. Debt markets or bond markets, there is no return. Currencies themselves were suspect. In other words, the dollar didn't know what was going to happen with the dollar, didn't know what was going to happen with the euro. So there was a very strong sense, what has value going forward? And everybody who's sitting in this room knows the answer to that question. What has value going forward is fresh water, arable land, and food. And Goldman had figured out a way to say, okay, you want to get in on this? You want to get in on this value, which is food and water and all these things? We've got a place for you to allocate your assets. And literally hundreds of billions of new dollars poured into these markets and really upset their equilibrium. So that would be the answer to that one, Anna.
So just to understand this better, so you're saying that this commodity price index or this commodity index that Goldman created, that it was only buying. So who was doing how and you're saying that goes against the buying and selling that we're used to.
Right.
So where was the selling happening? How was Goldman making money off of that? You know, did you just explain?
Okay, so Anna's pushing me to get into this kind of granular moment on commodity markets.
And if people have other questions, I'm reading them as they come up. We don't have
but
to go there.
I'll go there.
In 60 seconds.
Exactly. It's just what always happens, people, they think they're interested in how this works, and then, you know, a half an hour later when I'm still flapping about it, they're like, oh, shit, why didn't I go to the, you know, the Men Are From Venus thing? Right. You know, look, I should just be very honest about this, that I knew nothing about commodity markets and very little about economics before I started this project. And it literally took me a year. You might think I'm kidding. It literally took me a year to understand the most basic things about commodity markets. It was completely beyond me. And I spent a lot of time and effort studying it and then realizing I still didn't know what it meant, and then studying it again and realizing. And then, of course, once you figure out what it means, then it's another thing to then relate it in a book, or certainly relate it even more digressively or even more reductively talking to people. It's very hard. But the bottom line is
this. With that said, you're going to explain it to us right now.
But the bottom line is this. Okay, so the market, and this is going to be the last lesson on it. The market, the commodity markets basically are regulated in this way. 5 times a year those promises come due. Okay, so that they're called contracts. 5 times a year. That's it. So people trade wheat on the March, May, July, September, or December contract. That's it. Okay, that's how they're set up. Now, every time one of these contracts would come up, everybody in Chicago and Minneapolis and Kansas City, well, not Minneapolis, but Chicago and Kansas City would know that Goldman and the people behind the Goldman Sachs Commodity Index would, in a very small period of time, a week period of time, technically known as the quote-unquote role, in this quote-unquote role period, what Goldman would have to do is sell, okay, I was lying, they did sell, they would sell everything and then buy it all back plus more in that 1 week, so that their positions, their these quote-unquote positions of promising to buy wheat would transfer from one contract to the next, to the next, to the next, to the next ad infinitum. No, the wheat
Isn't
never,
it, it's
no,
so
no, the,
crazy.
That's the extraordinary thing about these markets. Let me just ask the question.
Does the wheat yeah.
ever get delivered?
Yeah.
No. And we, well, these are all, because it's really, that's the freaky thing. The freaky thing is that ultimately what they're talking about is just money. They're not talking at all about the actual real wheat. And what happened is that because of this craziness, this weird thing that was going on in the commodity markets, there's no insider trading laws in commodity markets. It's not like equity. It's not like stock markets where you can go to jail for insider trading. There are no insider trading laws. Everybody would know what was going to happen that week. And those guys made so much money. All the traders on the floor, they all knew, oh, the Goldman roll is coming. And they would know, and they would be able to buy into it, sell into it, do everything they wanted to do as they knew, because they had all this information, what that market would have to do in that one week period. Okay? And yes, there was never any wheat involved. It was all about these imaginary promises to buy and sell wheat. And the crazy thing is how these promises started to control the actual price of wheat. That the fantasy became, all of a sudden started to control the reality.
Right. So where this touches down is that it actually touches down in the real world in prices, right? It actually touches down in this is this abstract financialization of food happening, and Goldman Sachs is making profits.
Yeah, and the other outrage thing is that the farmer never saw this money. People always say, well, Fred, what are you complaining about? The farmer made more money as the price went up. No. No. The imaginary price was going through the roof. The farmer never got in on that imaginary price. The people who get in on that imaginary price were the bankers.
So questions are coming in. And one of the
fast and furious.
Yes. Yeah. So one of the questions is, are you suggesting that we should regulate food differently than other commodities? And if so, why?
That is a great question. Who asked that question? Thank you. Thank you. That's kind of the essence of the message, I would say. And that was what Anna and I were talking about really before we got up here to flap publicly. The idea is, and what I would say, is that yes, that food is different, that food needs to be regulated differently. And in fact, there's a real history for this. So for instance, why should banks be able to bet up the price of hunger? Why should they be able to bet on hunger? Why should they be able to do this? Well, there's no good reason. And in fact, they were not allowed to do this for many, many years. Ever since there have been commodity markets, people have always wanted to corner the market. They've always wanted to hoard. And so all the rules and regulations of these markets are trying to get those people out of it, to regulate them out of it, so that the people who participate are the people like the farmer and the baker and the consumer. Those are the people who can then, you know, are rightfully involved, and they should rightfully participate in these markets. Okay? And so this came to the attention particularly in the Great Depression in this country. And FDR, in his Agriculture Act of 1934, made a very specific law. And the law was that if you're not actively involved in buying and selling actual food, then you can't participate to that extent. You're not allowed in. So you had this two sets of participants. One are the quote-unquote, and there's a fancy word, the bona fide hedgers. Those are the people, the bakers and the warehousers and the millers and the farmers, who are bona fide interest in food and who are hedging their risk or managing their risk. And then there are speculators. They're the people who don't make wheat, would have no place to put it if they ever bought, if they actually ever came to them. They're just interested in the price fluctuations. And so FDR and his Agriculture Act said, okay, if you're just a speculator, and it's okay to have speculators in the market. I want to point that out too. It's okay to have them to a certain extent. All the commodity traders and the Wall Street guys, they always say, you need speculators in the market because they, quote unquote, they add liquidity to the market. Okay? And I think they're probably right. I think that to a certain extent, the farmers and the bakers can buy and sell on the futures markets. They're enabled to do that because there's speculative money selling and buying whatever they want to take in their positions. But they have to be kept in check. And so there are what were called position limits in the 1934 Agriculture Act. And they said, if you're a banker, let's say, you can only take this big of a stake in global wheat. And then what happened is we had this really like a 25 year since Reagan, this kind of and through Clinton, we had this a very strong sense that markets were gods and that we should let them alone and that if we regulated them we would ruin them and that we have to just let markets flourish and be free, okay? And so there was a lot of what's called deregulation. Instead of the markets being regulated, they were deregulated. And a big part of this was that many banks who understood the implications of the Goldman Sachs Commodity Index, they understood way before we did, they understood the implications of what might happen. They sent letters very privately to members of a federal government organization called the CFTC. And the CFTC is short for the Commodities Futures Trading Commission. Okay? And these are the guys who are in charge of the rules for trading commodities, CFTC. And they sent these letters from these banks, and it's still unclear which banks sent these letters, but about 8 of these letters went in. And what they asked for, in the great language of bureaucrats, position limit exemptions. Position limit exemptions. They'd be exempt from having to be limited in their positions. And the argument was, well, we trade in currency, right? I'm Bank of America, and I trade in global currency in my offices around the world. And isn't wheat the same as cash? And isn't cash the same as wheat? So I should be a bona fide hedger too. And they were granted these position limits. The Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform Act, one of the key linchpins of the act, was bringing back position limits to the commodity markets to try to tamp this down and bring it back to some sort of sanity. That was the law, and it was passed. And the CFTC, again, the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, has tried to implement the position limit law. This is not in my book. This is more recent history. They were sued by a lobbying association for global derivatives. Global derivatives is big business. We're talking about a $600 trillion business every year. So clearly they have money to pay people. And they got a very good lobbyist to head the effort, a guy named Eugene Scalia. His dad's more famous than he is. Right. And so Eugene Scalia led this effort in this lawsuit against the CFTC to stop this position limit law, and they actually won their lawsuit. They won their lawsuit. So even though it isn't Dodd-Frank, even in his law, there is no, at this point, there are no position limits, and the exemptions are still in place.
Let me jump to another question. Someone was asking about the connection between what you're talking about in terms of money and food politics and current farm bill. Specifically, how is or is the bank and financial sector setting policies for what we eat in the farm bill? What influence do they have there?
Well, what's interesting to me is this kind of huge rift between people interested in food and people who are interested in money. Which should not be the case. These things need to be intimately connected and connected in a way which fosters civilization, not one that ruins both finance and food. But what we're looking at this point, and you can see by a little bit of my description of what happened, is that to the bankers, the idea was food wasn't food. Food was actually a way of just getting money, a financial instrument that they could manipulate and use to make a lot of money for themselves, which is what they did. And so the Farm Bill is actually, to a great extent, about food. It's about food subsidies, about food insurance, about all these things relating to food. Bankers aren't particularly interested in it. They're, you know, what they're particularly interested is attempts to reform them out of the derivatives markets. So while there are all sorts of things we can talk about in the Farm Bill, right, banking is not really one of them. However, I should point out that there is one exception to that. And that now we're even more kind of eye-glazing than the notion of investing in commodity index funds is the whole notion of insurance, right? Insurance, farm insurance. And you know, this stuff is so incredibly boring, right? I could hardly read it, right? But a great deal of the Farm Bill is dedicated to insurance policies. And I was talking when I was actually oddly but incredibly invited to speak to the General Assembly of the United Nations about global speculation in commodity markets. And sitting next to me, I won't tell you his name, was an ex-trader who was also, you can find him, he was also speaking up against speculation. And I said to him, what are you doing? You're a financial guy. You're a derivatives guy. What happened to you? Why are you now speaking up against this? And what it turned out is that actually he's left the trading business because he knows there's more money in the insurance part of the business. And what he's very interested in is getting, you know, connected up the wazoo at the UN with how that crop insurance is going to play out in Africa, which, as we all know, is kind of the next big playing field of global commodities.
Interesting. All right, let me ask another question from someone in the audience. So is there an incentive for commodity farmers to band together against bankers to advocate for food price transparency?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely there is. And I think there's some very interesting movements out there. There are actually non-commodity grain farmers now who are trying to figure out ways that they can go directly to the market with non-commodity grain as opposed to going to the middlemen and having their grain be commodity. But I think one of the solutions is because the commodity markets are so broken at this point, some of the solutions are trying to fix it, bring back position limits. Other solutions are end around it. You know, just try to buy your grain from other sources, from other places, and to sell your grain through other places and through other sources.
When you say other places, other sources, what do you mean by that?
Well, the farming has never been a completely vertically integrated business. In other words, if you notice, McDonald's don't own farms, right? They don't own livestock or farms. They are leaving that to other people to take care of them for them, because of course it's a very risky business being a farmer. It's a capital intensive business being a farmer. It's a tough business being a farmer. They don't want to have anything to do with it. They're happy using the futures markets to get their commodity beef, their commodity grain, their commodity soy, right? And so the farmer has not had a lot of experience, particularly the wheat farmer, the corn farmer, the soy farmer, really does not have a lot of experience vertically going from that farm all the way to the supermarket, right? And some very smart grain farmers, however, are doing just that, and they figured out ways to mill their wheat, bring their flour to the market, and to say, this flour never went through the commodity mill, and it goes straight to you. So, yeah, I think there is a lot of incentive. I mean, I'm talking about a very small segment. This is a very small part of the market. So we have to remember that this is not, you know, at this point a real viable solution to bankers being involved in the global food system. But there is a real incentive for, Anna just sent me a note earlier today about sustainable commodity wheat. So there's a very strong sense that something's broken here, and people are now beginning to try and theorize how to fix it.
So let's stick with the how to fix it theme. And one of the people you talk about in your book is Bill Gates and the Gates Foundation and what the Gates Foundation is doing and proposing to help solve the hunger crisis globally. And I'd love for you to just share your perspective on that, what you talk about in the book, and you know, what is Bill Gates suggesting as one of the solutions to hunger, as you say in the book?
Well, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, they have, I think, the best intentions in the world. I do. I think they have great intentions. And I also think that a lot of the things that they've been doing, in terms of AIDS, in terms of malaria, I think it's been, it's admirable. However, I think that Bill Gates is very much taken with the romance of the food killer app and the idea of virtual food, which is commodity markets, food that isn't really food, food that's kind of sort of food or suggests food or is meta food, right? And so he's very much taken with this idea of commodity markets stabilizing prices, which is what they did 150 years ago. And so at the United Nations, there's a very strong effort to bring commodity markets to, as I was saying earlier, to some of the most impoverished and really terrible places on earth where farmers really aren't making a living, and to try to implement American-style commodity markets, let's say in Rwanda and Uganda. And one of the scariest moments of my life was actually having a very public conversation with Bill Gates at the United Nations and a public argument with him. In which he actually got very angry at me because I was suggesting that instead of solving this problem, he was creating more of a problem. Because I think what we're seeing again and again and again with many of the kind of good-hearted efforts of the quote-unquote developed world to help the developing world is that the developing world doesn't want to be developed the way the developed world already is, and so we can't just kind of put our blanket on top of them. And what happens, and we saw it in the Green Revolution, and I fear it will happen with commodity markets, we're seeing the same kind of phenomena, which is the very rich people in these developing nations continue to fill their pockets and get rich, and the very poor people, the peasant farmers, continue to suffer terribly. And so I don't think that is a viable solution, even though that is the solution that the Gates Foundation is funding at this point with the World Food Program.
And he talks about this in his book. He sets the scene of this heated conversation with Bill Gates. So let me jump to another question. What have we lost in nutrition, in the nutritional value of food, with the financialization of food? Is there a nutrition connection?
Yeah, well, I think that, once again, there are really two parts to the food question. And so a lot of people will ask a variation on that question, which, again, is that why is the price of food so high, right? And the farmer doesn't get anything from it. And why then is so much food so bad, right? And so there are these two contradictory forces in this monster system, the global food system. And once again, we're kind of verging into this moment of complexity. Right, I was reading Paul Roberts' book, which was published in 2005, called The End of Food, and it's a very good book. And in it, he talks about how global food, the problems with the global food system, is very simply the most complicated problem on Earth. That is there is no more complicated problem, because not only does it deal with politics and finance and economics and farming techniques and nutrition and consumer and, every possible thing in health and nutrition, all these things are kind of snarled up in this very tangled ball, right? And so one of the forces that's really messing up with nutrition and is this kind of Walmartification of the market, this push of the industrialized food makers like Domino's Pizza and McDonald's and Coca-Cola. They're trying to push their ingredients, the price, down and down and down, okay? At the same time, what we're seeing is the bankers perceiving that the price of food should go up and up and up, right? And so you have this odd situation where you have the people who have previously been the villains in the food movement, in our eyes, the McDonald's and the Pepsis, actually having a big problem as they face even bigger bullies, who are the bankers who are actually screwing up their business model, because you can't have, you know, McDonald's isn't a business if a Big Mac costs $20, right? They're out of business, right? And so in the World Economic Forum, which is held at Davos every year, for the past couple of years, there are these meetings of all these guys like the CEO of Coke and Pepsi sit down at the same table, and they say, what are we going to do about these commodities which are spiraling out of control? How do we handle this problem? How do we handle this? And they've come up with all sorts of interesting hedging techniques. Maybe I haven't quite made it clear the horror of this. You know, I haven't quite been visceral enough with what people are doing with commodity trading now. I think people understand this kind of momentum trading in Wall Street, you know, this arbitrage with stocks that computers are running out of hedge fund offices in Connecticut, you know, this sort of thing. Monsters computers trading, you know, 10,000 trades in 1 second, which is what they're doing. That same thing is happening with commodity markets. You know, our original example was in 2 month increments. Right, we're seeing 10,000 trades a second in commodities. This is not food anymore that we're dealing with. And so the people with Coke and Kellogg's, they're also a little bit dumbfounded. They're not set up for a situation where food is being traded this way, and they don't quite know what to make of it, except to hire a bunch of math PhDs from MIT to come be on their team. You know, in fact, I was talking to one guy this morning up in down in Monterey, who's actually working with a very large software company whose name shall not be uttered, Voldemort, the Voldemort of software companies, actually figuring out a way around for the Kellogg's and the Coca-Cola's, a way around the problems of what's going on with momentum trading and commodities, because it turns out that no matter how good these guys get, these guys meaning Kellogg's, they always end up buying and selling at the peaks and the valleys, whereas the Wall Street guys are making the money right through the middle by arbitraging the middle all the way through. And so, I know, I'm talking finance instead of food. But the idea was he's going to offer a new software program to large food industrialists to say maybe, once again, we'll do an end around the commodity markets, which have been so perverted and subverted, these markets, and we're going to do an end around and maybe figure out a way to source our ingredients other ways than through commodity sugar, commodity cheese, commodity milk, commodity everything.
So it sounds like a kind of food industry killer app.
That would be the idea. If it succeeds, he will make a lot of money.
Right, right. Well, so, I mean, I think this brings us to a couple of questions that have come up, which is kind of a combination of, like, where's the outrage around this, that this is happening to our food? But secondly, if Dodd-Frank isn't doing it here in this country, are there other examples of where commodity markets are being reined in to create that stabilization that we need?
No, in fact, it's quite the opposite. Commodity markets are being let loose. There are some efforts to control the global derivatives markets, but of course, as you can imagine, they're met with unbelievable opposition. Where's the outrage? Well, this is the problem. It's very hard to get people outraged about you know, subverted commodity markets. It's just not very sexy, right? You should be outraged, and people should be outraged about the price of food, and for a very good reason, which is that not only just that everybody eats, but that for instance, let's look at the Arab Spring for a second. Look at Egypt, right? What happened to Egypt? The regime changed there. Why did that happen? Well, there are many different theories, but one of the theories that nobody ever denies is the fact that in Egypt they were looking at food inflation at like 40% each month, right? Egypt is the world's largest importer of grain, and the price of grain had quadrupled. They couldn't do anything about it. It's kind of the dark side of globalism. And so their food inflation went through the roof. And what's going to make you guys and us get out into the street protesting? Well, I think that if a quart of milk costs $25 And if a pound of hamburger meat costs $50, that's when I get out in the street. You know, that's when I say, you know, I'm not spending $25 for a quart of milk for my kid or something like this, because that's an outrage. And that's what happened in Egypt. They were just enough. The middle class, when the middle class gets out in the street, for the most part, it's because of food inflation. And so you can see it in Iran. You can see it in Syria. A good part of the work of forces in this country that are very interested in regime change is to do everything they can to increase food inflation in these countries so that you get a revolution from within. This was part and parcel of an article I posted in Huffington Post not too long ago during the election, attacking Paul Ryan for the fact that he wanted to undo a lot of food assistance and food subsidy programs, food stamps, right? How foolish. How foolish in a time of rising food price to undo food assistance. And not only how foolish, but how dangerous. I said he is, you know, Paul Ryan is doing Al-Qaeda a favor, right? You want revolution? That's the surest and quickest path.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the themes in your book is this whole idea that this model is at its core unsustainable. If the definition of sustainability is a system that can continue, that this model is unsustainable. And there's this one scene I wanted to be sure to mention from the book that it's like stuck in my mind of Fred was at a Domino's pizza factory watching this production happen. And there's these, as you, one could guess, at a Domino's pizza factory, there's huge amounts of dough being produced. And at one point, Fred said to one of the guys operating these machines, are you sure that dough that you're catapulting into that huge bowl is going to make it? You know, and they're, oh, we've never had any accident here. And then a few seconds later, as you describe it in the book, you see this rogue ball of dough fall onto the floor and start oozing across the floor.
Yes, so there is a God for journalists.
That's right. So I have this image of the, you know, the sort of to me, kind of one of the metaphors from your book is picturing this rogue ball of dough, you know, out of the control of the food company, oozing out across the floor. But you talk about how at that moment you're reflecting on being at the Domino's headquarters. You talk about how the CEO at the time, say the CEO and his crew were not simply rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. They were using math and science and business school analytics to find the very best way to rearrange those chairs to sustain the unsustainable. So can you talk a bit about what you're getting at there?
Yeah, I think that if you do go and happen to talk to the people at Domino's, or I was lucky enough to be welcomed by the people at Tyson Foods to be brought into their midst and to see what they were up to. You know, they inevitably they talk about their efforts towards sustainability. And this is most clear with our friends at Walmart, where I spent a good deal of time in Arkansas for this too. And I think there's a real danger when we start talking about sustainability, because it's one of those terms that's become virtually meaningless. I think everybody knows what it should mean, but people in the food industry, for instance, also know what it should mean. And they're trying to figure out a way that they can use this for their own benefit. And sustainability then becomes a marketing tool for themselves. And the problem with sustainability at this moment is that there is no measurement. Nobody can actually say this is a unit of sustainability, kind of like a calorie or even a measure of fat or something like this. It would be nice if we could come up with some sort of unit of sustainability, and that is just what people at the University of Arkansas are doing at the behest of Walmart, is they're trying to crunch as many numbers as possible, the water and the can. I spend a lot of time following a jar of Ragu tomato sauce, which the people at Walmart are selling and the people at Unilever are making, and Unilever is a global leader in sustainability. And following this nonsense all the way through, as they keep on calculating and calculating and calculating, trying to come up with some sort of metric of sustainability, which does not exist. It does not exist at this point. And so I think we all have to be very careful and somewhat skeptical about claims of the food industry or very large food retailers, when they put a little green stamp or a little sustainability certification, what exactly does that mean?
Yeah, I remember going to my first global sustainable food summit of it was all of the Grocery Manufacturers Association had their first sustainability summit, and sitting in one of the workshops, one of the attendees from a company that will remain nameless said, look, he raised his hand, he said, look, everyone, we all know the consumer is starting to really care about sustainability. They don't really understand it. They don't really care exactly what you do. As long as they feel like you're doing something, that's what matters. And it was that moment of kind of honesty of, you know, the executives talking to executives to hear that. So I want to wrap up, and I want to suggest a couple things if you're feeling a little bit of outrage. First, I suggest that you get a copy of Fred's book, Bet the Farm. He'll be here afterward to sign books, and you can buy copies out in the lobby. And you can also follow Fred on Twitter and Facebook and at his website, American Stomach. And I want to encourage all of you to follow his work. He's one of the journalists who covers these issues that I trust to really help me understand some of the most important issues in our lives, I would argue. So thank you all for coming out tonight, and thank you, Fred.
Thank you, Anna. Thank you, Phil. Thank you all.
Our thanks to Anna LaPay and Frederick Kaufman for their comments here today. We also thank our audiences here as well as those listening to this recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 110th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.